Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone and Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
I've been doing a great deal of thinking about who I am and why I've been sent here to live among you. And the answer is really very simple. Things here are just not working out very well.
Your jobs are boring, your food is bland,
your water is polluted, and your relationships don't work. Is that not right? And the question is, how have things come to such a sorry state of affairs? I will tell you. There is too much bad stuff around. Bad food, bad drink, bad art, bad ideas. Everything's all clogged up. So what we're going to do is we're going to get rid of all the bad stuff, and that will be a very good beginning. Now, I have here a list of things which I'd like written in the Constitution immediately, after which I promise you your lives will be less tense and more rewarding. One, all muzak in elevators, airports, restaurants, and other public rooms will cease immediately. Two, no more children or animals may be used to sell products. Three, lawyers who lose cases will go to jail with their clients. Four, no doctor may write a diet book. Any doctor who does will immediately lose his license and become a dentist. Five,
I think we don't really need a House of Representatives and a Senate. The Romans didn't have one, so let's just have a Senate, okay?
Which reminds me, I think it would be a very good idea from now on all politicians who appeared in public wore a cone-shaped party hat. Not bad, huh? Six, pollution. Anybody who owns a factory that makes radioactive waste has to take it home at night with him to his house. Seven, anybody who says, I'm trying to get centered, you are invading my space, or far out, will be fined $50. Make that $100.
Welcome to the Projection Booth. I'm Mike White. Joining me is Man About Town, Mr. Rob St. Mary.
Well, glad to be here. Where am I?
You're in the Projection Booth, where we are covering the film Simon, the 1980 film from Marshall Brickman. Simon is the tale of, you guessed it, a guy named Simon, Professor Simon Mendelsohn, to be exact. He's played by Alan Arkin in one of his best performances. Simon is a self-important know-it-all who gets snookered by a nefarious brain trust who secretly rule the world. They want to see what would happen if an alien were to land on Earth, and they make Simon think he's the alien via a sensory deprivation tank. That's just kind of scratching the surface of this delightful comedy. So, Rob, what did you think of Simon?
Well, I have to say, if you go to projection-booth.com, there's a photo of the poster that we have up, and I remember seeing the poster like years ago. Just this sort of like, I couldn't quite figure it out. It looked like Alan Arkin, like dressed like a seal or something, and he's making like this odd face, and kind of didn't know how to deal with that, so I never saw it until you brought it up on the show. But once I saw it, this was a revelation to me, like what we were talking about on the St. Jack episode, where it's one of those films that maybe you heard about or you didn't really know about, and then you get a chance to see it. And it was really enjoyable. And beyond that, actually, I'd have to say this is probably one of those films that I would love to go back to again and again, because there are certain things about it. While some of it is dated, I will admit that, I think that a lot of the ideas in it are things that I often talk about. So maybe I'm feeling some kinship with the self-important know-it-all professor.
So we should probably talk a little bit about the film. It opens up with the revelation of this brain trust, where we have pretty much every awesome character actor who has ever played like a nerd or nerdy professor guy ever, all in one place. And I think it's one of the best casts of guys that I've ever seen. I mean, you've got like Wallace Shawn and William Finley.
You have Madeline Kahn in a role that's really nice. But the one I was really excited to see is Max Wright. And if that name doesn't sound familiar to you, but you grew up in the 80s, you probably know who Mr. Wright is. He was Willie, the father on Elf.
Something that he's probably very proud of still to this day.
And he's a Detroiter.
Yes. So, yeah, amazing. All of these guys in one film. And then we find out that they pretty much rule the world through all of these different experiments. And I love as we have kind of this ponderous narrator talking about it. And then he kind of becomes like the question asker and almost kind of narrates the film a little bit, at least in the beginning, by asking questions of these scientists as we go through and see what they're up to.
It is not generally known that many of the strange and alarming trends observed in this country in recent years were not random occurrences, coincidences, or so-called acts of God, but are, in fact, directly traceable to this group of men, five of the most brilliant and twisted geniuses in America, perhaps in the entire world. Living and working together, isolated, protected, and funded by a government contract so brilliantly incomprehensible that no one, even at the highest Washington levels, knew its real activities. This group, in the name of free scientific inquiry, perpetrated a series of scenarios so sinister, so bizarre, and so childishly perverse that rational men argued that the civilization which had come so far in so short a time was finally collapsing. Dr. Carl Becker, director of the Institute.
Excuse me, Dr. Becker?
Oh, yes?
How did the five of you meet?
We were all sent out here some years ago by someone who thought it would be a good idea for the best minds to be put together in a good environment with unlimited funds.
And what were you all supposed to do?
Oh, think.
A think tank? What about?
The usual, you know, the food shortage, ecology, energy, that sort of thing. We were supposed to save the world.
What went wrong?
Nothing went wrong. We just got into more interesting material, that's all.
More interesting material? What kind of material?
Oh, a little this, a little that.
I love the voiceover. I think the voiceover in the beginning is hilarious. It gets us in really fast. Marshall Brickman, as you said, worked with Woody Allen. And it reminded me a little bit of the John Carradine role in Everything You Always Want to Know About Sex But We're Afraid to Ask, where he plays the mad professor who's doing all these odd experiments.
Here I'm studying premature ejaculation in a hippopotamus.
How often does that problem come up with a hippo?
Here I'm forcing a man to have intercourse with a large rye bread. They're getting on famously. Here, I'm going to take the brain of a lesbian and put it into the body of a man who works for the telephone company.
But why? What good will this do anybody?
It'll show those fools who'll call me mad.
There's a lot of fourth wall in this between the voiceover and certain characters talking to us, talking to the audience. And I thought that that was really interesting. It was done really well.
Most of the scientists are doing the fourth wall stuff, but Simon is pretty much clueless when it comes to him being in this film. He's very much living in his own world. And when we first see him, he's giving this speech in a philosophy class where he's just, I don't know, like everything he's talking about, it's like, you know, every word that comes out of my mouth is so important. It's kind of like that Jeff Goldblum syndrome, you know, where it's like, it sounds like everything he says is meant to be, you know, written down someplace.
That's right. And the one that he says, and I think it pops up several times, is the idea that I thought was probably the most profound over all that stuff that he was saying was, you can change the world with an idea, but you have to think of the idea first.
So we've got him, and he's doing his experiments doing sensory deprivation, which is funny because this was actually the same year that Altered States came out. So we've got two movies in the same year that are focused pretty much right there on sensory deprivation tanks, which is kind of weird. And really, there's a similar kind of thing that happens where William Hurt kind of goes back in time, like down the mitochondrial DNA chain, and, you know, kind of devolves. And pretty much Simon does the same thing when they take him and they put him in a tank for, what is it, like 200 hours or something. And when he comes out, he pretty much has to go through evolution starting at the beginning.
And that's the thing that's amazing about this whole, what I'll call the evolution of life, and then the ascent of man. And this is where Alan Arkin, as a physical actor in that era, is so good, because this is where you realize how his Second City training paid off. You know, for those that don't know, Alan Arkin, before he got into film, was in, if he wasn't in the first group of the folks in Second City, he was pretty close to the beginning in the 50s. And you can tell from just watching this sort of like from protozoa to man, and then the whole sort of like riff on 2001, that all of this came out of his physical improv sort of miming ability in order to get himself into a space and act that kind of bizarre on camera or on stage in front of a bunch of people and be able to play it and do it really well.
it's definitely one of the highlights of the place. And that's where we get the poster image that kind of scared you away for all that time.
Yeah, it's kind of a bizarre little poster. It's black and white. And as I said, it's got Alan Arkin, and he's got this bizarre face, and he's like dressed in this almost like seal costume, which I didn't know what it was. But obviously I know now, because he was in the sensory deprivation tank, it's actually a wetsuit. So it's just an amazing piece of performance that it probably goes on for what, like, it feels like 3 or 4 minutes. And it's pretty amazing to watch.
To see him go from a protozoa all the way up to discovering language and becoming the man that he eventually comes, who is basically, he gets convinced, they hypnotize him and give him a new memory, and they convince him that he's an alien. And then we get to see pretty much him kind of unchecked as he goes through and says everything that pretty much is on his mind and tries to make the world a better place.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. It's in terms of that idea of him coming out and then sort of talking to the world in that way. I can't really think of other films or other. I think maybe the closest to this in a way, and it's much more in a political bend, is Bullworth, where Warren Beatty's character takes out a contract on himself. He's a senator. And then after he realizes that he's going to die, he starts speaking the truth. Now with this, it's much more like he's had himself erased. He believes himself to be something else. And now he just has to tell everybody the truth because he believes he has all these insights, which is funny because I think even if his memory wasn't erased or whatever, this implant or whatever you want to call it of his new persona, he would still do these things. It's just he feels more uninhibited to do it now than when he did when he was before, because you get sort of the feeling that this attitude, this persona of his, was there even when he was messing around in the early days.
Now he's got a pulpit. Pretty much he goes from having this pulpit as he's being revealed as the alien, and, you know, wants to give press conferences and has this kind of being beamed into across the world's televisions. And, you know, we have the montage of him, you know, being on all these different magazine covers and being interviewed all over the place. And then after that, he kind of becomes a prophet in a different way, again, through the medium of television, when he has a van where he can beam himself into everyone's house and take over the three channels that they have back then. I think there's a remark someplace that Simon is the fourth network, and he just takes over everything and he pretty much feels the need to educate everyone in the world. Sits there and he reads things to people and just fetches all the time as far as what needs to change to make the world a better place. And he's got something really against music and elevators.
Yes, Muzak is terrible. As you heard in the opening, the preview, there's not really a preview for this film that we found, so we used that one section, Mike. And I love that kind of discussion where he's talking about sort of this idea of America with no culture. You know, your food's bland, your TV sucks, you know, what do you know about art? You know, it's just this place, it's horrible. It's just, you know, big suburban nightmare hell. And I guess maybe growing up in big suburban nightmare hell as a kid, maybe that's why I relate to him, because there's so many things that he goes off on. And then to sort of add to it is when he becomes prophet, he stumbles upon these folks that are sort of a cult.
They worship the cathode ray, as it were. And I love that he's educating them, but yet they're just taking it in verbatim and just completely, you know, just regurgitating it back out to him with really no thought. So even though he's trying to educate people, they still just aren't quite getting it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that whole thing about them worshiping TV kind of reminded me of Videodrome, but obviously not as sinister, much more comedic. And the idea that, you know, their Bible has, they've replaced the King James with the TV guide.
Yeah, I love the whole Deuteronomy thing.
And Milty begat Lucy, who begat Mary, who spun off Rhoda, who spun off Phyllis.
Amen. It's just wonderful, crazy sort of like satire. It'd be interesting in a way, you know, because all of this is very much, like I said, in terms of it being dated, I mean, it's very much stuck in the 70s, you know, turn of 1980. So it's the technology of the era. It's the ideas of the era. It's the media that it's satiring of the era. It's not to say that I don't think that TV can be satired. I mean, now we have, instead of three channels, as he was dealing with, like 3,000 channels. But it would be interesting to see what you could do with Simon in a modern context in terms of social media and all the other various channels we have in terms of a mediated idea.
It really kind of reminds me of, you had mentioned Bulworth, and I was thinking of another one of your favorite films, which was Idiocracy, as far as this whole like guy coming in and trying to repair what's going on. I mean, the culture that Simon is railing against is he perceives it as being very dumb. But then we have, you know, the observer, what's his name, like Joe, right, in Idiocracy, who comes in and sees what really awful, I mean, even worse culture is. I mean, pretty much, you know, 2010 culture. And, he's there trying to rail against that, though not as verbose as Simon is.
I think in a way what something like this film, and I mean Idiocracy to some extent does have some futuristic stuff, but I think the one thing that I really like about Simon is that I'll call this sort of a contemporary science fiction, in that there's a few things that are a little anachronistic, things that are supposed to be a little more futuristic in some way. But it's sort of the sci-fi of the everyday, and in a way it's kind of reminds me of a film like Alphaville, where, you know, you're just shooting around sort of the everyday place. You got a couple of different colored lights, or maybe even World on a Wire, the Fassbender, when we did 13th Floor, in that you can have this sort of other world that's created that is a little bit out of joint, a little bit out of step, and it works that way because of the way they stage it and the way they set it. So it's not that any of this stuff is, you know, you need big effects for it or something like that in order to make it work. You just have really great performances and a few, you know, odds and ends, and you're doing all right.
That the weapon that is in the film is just a gas. I mean, we don't even get to see it. So it just is perfect. You know, talk about just a lack of props, which is great.
And then there's a couple of other things that I like in here. One thing is when you get towards the end and sort of how all this stuff kind of builds is, you know, he ends up becoming this media darling. He becomes this celebrity of weirdness. And it seems like you don't necessarily know if he's Marshall Brickman is satirizing media and its willingness to glom on to someone and follow them around until they, you know, because they're a beautiful car crash, or if they actually believe in some manner that this man might actually be an alien. It's never really brought out that, oh, he's just crazy, so why are we listening to him? Their incredulity or their ability to just, you know, swallow it whole is also interesting, as you were saying with the cult.
All right, we're going to take a break, and we'll be back with an interview with Marshall Brickman, the writer-director of Simon.
Everyone wants to spice things up in the bedroom. Here's an offer you won't want to miss. For a limited time, you'll get 50% off just about any one item at adamandeve.com. Yes, get 50% off when you use the coupon code BOOF at checkout, as in John Wilkes Powers or the Projection Booth. But that's not all. You'll also receive 3 free adult DVDs and free shipping on your entire order. Too good to be true? It's not. Check out adamandeve.com today for this special offer. Once again, that coupon code is BOOTH at adamandeve.com.
This is Jamie from Devour the Podcast. Do you enjoy horror commentary with straightforward honesty?
Oh my God, fuck this movie. Fuck this movie so hard.
Oh my goodness. You know, halfway through this movie, I was just like, let's get this thing going.
Fuck this movie.
Humor and an obvious passion for the genre.
Like, I'm good, baby. I'll kick him in the face.
I like the cut of your jib.
The ceiling, Grandma. Don't make me get out the broom.
Oh, your tears are like wine.
They used to call that the vapors.
Cupcakes are kind of the Schindler's List of desserts. It's a pure good.
I love the idea of up-and-coming horror directors taking on the found footage genre. I really, really like that idea.
And that's really the worst thing you can commit as far as filmmaking is concerned, is making a film that's just average.
Well, that doesn't really inspire any kind of discussion, whether it's, you know, to rip it apart or praise it.
Then you should spend time with David and me.
And Bo.
As we discuss horror films from old classics.
Deep Red. Empire of the Ants. Lisa and the Devil. The Baby. The Toxic Avengers.
The New Favorites.
Absentia. Cabin in the Woods. The Loved Ones. Shadow of Death. VHS. The Woman.
Check us out on iTunes or at devourthepodcast.blogspot.com. Devour the Podcast is a proud member of the Horrorphilia Podcasting Network.
Good evening, folks. Do you enjoy action and adventure, romance and comedy? How about long strolls on the beach and a fine champagne by moonlight? Do you like piña coladas and getting caught in the rain? Or would you rather listen to some in-depth conversation about film where many timely and poignant observations and witticisms are made? Mo here from the Drunk on VHS podcast. And if you like any of those things, then I have some bad news for you. Drunk on VHS has none of these. But you should listen anyway, because I asked him nicely and said, please. Oh, wait. Please. Tune in every Wednesday for new episodes exclusively at CouchKitchen.com.
Bring the family. Bring your friends.
We're going to be doing an episode about Simon.
Oh, my.
And so I was hoping to talk to you about that. And I was also hoping to talk to you a little bit about your background as well, just because it seems like you've got a fascinating story going on. It, from what I've read, you were actually in a band with Alan Arkin for a while?
No, actually, he was in a group called the Tarriers, a group that he started when I think I was probably still in college. And then, you know, like often happened with those folk groups, you know, people left and other people came in to replace them. So at a later date, I was a member of that same group.
Ah, okay. Wow, what a small world, huh?
Yeah, it is. And then later, of course, I directed him in that movie.
So how did you go from the Terriers to the Dick Cavett Show?
I was, I don't know if you're old enough to remember, but back in the day when the folk groups were playing around nightclubs and the coffee shops, there was always one guy who talked and did jokes mm-hmm. while the other guys tuned up. So I was that guy. So I started writing little, you know, comedy pieces for myself to keep the audience distracted. And that's kind of the way I got into writing a little bit. And then at the Bitter End, which was one of those, you know, estuaries, one of those very early folk music coffee houses, Woody Allen was our opening act, actually. We were the Tarriers. We were the headliner. He was the opening act. And we both handled, both our group and Woody were handled by the same management office. And so Woody and I became friends. So I sort of left the music business and started to get into writing. And then I got a job working on the Tonight Show, on the Carson Show, the Tonight Show with when Johnny Carson was the host in New York. That was around 1968 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Then I moved from there when Dick got his show on ABC opposite Carson. Dick and I had become friends, and I moved over to become a producer and head writer for him. I think that answers your question. I mean, I never made any plan in my life, which is what I keep telling my kids, that my life is no example of how to plan a life. I kind of gravitated toward the people that I wanted to have lunch with. One thing kind of led to the other. But there was always a thing behind it, I guess, having to do with writing, which mm-hmm. was always my primary interest, except for the music, you know. But you know, I didn't want to be a folk singer at the old age of 30. You know, I wanted to do something a little more, I don't know, with a bigger horizon, perhaps.
And then you continued to work with Woody Allen over on Sleeper, right?
Yeah, Woody and I started to work together while I was still the head writer for Carson, and then later on with Dick. He was sort of breaking out at that time. You know, he had gone from writing himself to doing a stand-up act around town, and then he started to appear on television a little bit. We worked together on some of his material. Then later on. He got a couple of television specials, you know, one-hour specials, and we wrote those, and then we started writing the films. All the while I had a kind of a day job. See, I was on the Tonight Show from 67 to 70, and on the Cavett Show from 1970 to about 72 or 73. And then, of course, Sleeper was like 74, 75, I guess, and that's when I kind of left television and went into film. Sleeper was about 74, 75, and then Annie Hall was, I think, 77. We made it in 76, I guess.
You had a little bit of success with Annie Hall, right?
Well, you know, in a way, yes. It you know, that film had a much greater impact than you would imagine if you saw the grosses on it. You know, I think it's probably the lowest grossing film that ever won four major Academy Awards. But it did have a big cultural impact. And, of course, it did kind of set us both up, certainly Woody. And to a lesser extent, it set me up too, because I could get my phone calls answered, and I did have a script ready, which was Simon. I kind of suspected that we might make a little noise at the Academy Awards. We didn't know, you know, how much. So I wanted to be ready with something because I wanted to start directing and the writing out on my own.
I was very fortunate. I managed to get a copy of the early draft of Simon. I think it might have been one of the first drafts. And it is markedly different from what ended up on screen. Can you tell me a little bit about how the project kind of came together and progressed?
Yes. Woody had the idea he wanted to do a silent movie, actually. He wanted to do a movie without any dialogue. And we started to kick that around. And another thing, we had very grandiose ideas. The original concept that never really made it to script, but the original idea was a two-parter. I mean, you know, something, you know, on the scale of like Exodus or something, where there would be a story, a contemporary story of this guy living in New York in contemporary times. And then, you know, he would go into the hospital for an operation and he would, there would be a problem and he'd be frozen, you know, cryogenically. And there would be an intermission. This is, you know, very grand. And, and then people would go out and buy popcorn and soda and then come back. And then the next half, you know, the second act, as it were, would be in the future. And we were very, very early on disabused of that kind of idea. It just was totally impractical to film something of that scope and scale and everything. So we kind of condensed it. And the second thing that happened was that we kind of realized, as we were talking about it, that our strong suit really was not visuals, but it was ideas, which could be expressed best in dialogue. But you know, one of the early, I don't know if that's in the early script. I doubt it. We conceived of a civilization in the future where speech was a privilege rather than just, you know, that only certain, you know, levels, the certain classes, the higher classes of society were actually permitted to speak and everybody else was silent. You know, we didn't really go far enough to work that out. But that was our rationale for making a silent, you know, movie. But then we realized that kind of what the audience would expect, certainly from us and generally was it's, you know, very hard to tell a story that wouldn't seem so old-fashioned, you know, like, you know, Buster Keaton or, you know, a silent movie. And so we pretty soon abandoned that idea, but we did work on it for a while. And so that's kind of one aspect of you know, the way we were thinking about it that never made it to script. Now, things that did make it to the script and were ultimately cut out or filmed and eventually cut out, I don't know, does the version you have have a dream sequence in which there's a human-sized chess set in which Woody plays a white pawn? That was a sequence. There is a dream sequence in the film itself. It's been a while since I saw it, but he goes to sleep and they sort of visualize his dreams on like a screen. One of the things that Woody actually shot out in the desert was a giant chess game with real people, you know, as the chess pieces and the knights on real horses, and Woody plays a white pawn. And diagonally opposite him is a black bishop. And then I mean a black, you know, African-American, you know, all the black were black. And then there's the voice of the player, you know, which is like the voice of God saying, well, maybe I should sacrifice that pawn in order to, you know, do whatever. And then I believe Woody, in a panic, runs off the board. It was a very funny idea and very elaborate and filmed beautifully, but it never made it to the final cut. So, you know, there were a whole lot of rather, you know, original, maybe brilliant ideas that, you know, as always happens, kind of stop the story. You know, when the author is trying to show off, you know, and finally people don't care, they say, just, you know, get on with it. So some of that, unfortunately, wound up on the cutting room floor. And I guess you can compare the script you have with the final cut, and you'd know better than I what was left out.
Seems like there's kind of a dotted line from Sleeper over to Simon.
You know, not consciously, really. You know, the idea for Simon just occurred to me. I think I was kicking some ideas around with my friend Tom, who's the co-author on that, and we did a kind of what if, you know, what if the think tank wanted to find out how the society would react to the appearance of an alien. You know, what it is really is a satire. You know, it's a very, it kind of is a little cult favorite, but, it, you know, when I look at it now, it's a very kind of cold, film full of ideas. It's like a lot of first films where you put every idea that you ever thought of into the movie because you're afraid they'd never let you make a second one. But, you know, I'm kind of a science freak. I mean, I went to Brooklyn Technical High School and I was a physics major in college before I switched to music just to have some fun before I got out. And so I've always been kind of fascinated with science and sociology. You know, I mean, it's really a satire about contemporary life, obviously, and so is Sleeper, you know, just using the future to make a comment on what's going on now. So yeah, there is a kind of a, I mean, but there is a dotted line or even a, you know, an unbroken line between the two, but not consciously, like so much of what I do is sort of unconscious.
I kind of misspoke before. What I was actually saying was that I had an early draft of Simon from 77. So it felt like there was a, if you wrote that and you're ready for it after Annie Hall, I mean, it took quite a few years before you actually got that out, right? That was, 77 to 80, did you release that?
Simon? I don't know. I don't remember. I guess it must have been about that, yeah. You know, but very soon after we won the award, the people at Orion, I guess this was Orion, not UA, it was Orion, said, you know, have you got anything? And I said, well, I just, as a matter of fact, I do. So it took a while to wait for Alan and the other things, and then, you know, but it wasn't a long wait, I don't think. Maybe it was a year to pull it together.
Yeah, the cast is amazing for this film.
Those that are still living, huh? It's amazing how many are gone. I know. Let's see, Alan and Judy Grobart and Madeline.
And then just the scientists with William Finley and Austin Pendleton.
Austin. You know, Austin is a catastrophic stammerer. I don't know if you know that. He has a terrible stammer. And like many stammerers, you might ask, why choose that profession if you're a stammerer? But he did. And like many stammerers, he never knew on any particular day which was the bad consonant. You know, is it going to be a B? Is it going to be a D? You know, that he couldn't pronounce. And as it turned out, the name of his character in Simon, if I recall, was Dr. Carl Becker. I didn't know that he was a stammer, and I didn't know, you know, we could have called him something else. It would have been easy to pronounce. So there are many, many takes where he had to introduce himself, you know, to the camera, to somebody, and he would say, how do you do? I'm Dr. You know, all right, cut. Let's do it again. Okay. All right. Hi, I'm... my name is Dr. Carl. Sorry, on and on and on. But he got through it. But that was a funny obstacle for him.
With the original script, it felt like Simon was kind of more of a person that bad stuff was happening to him, and in the final film, the character seems a little bit more like, almost like he deserves it a little bit, just because he kind of is a blowhard.
He deserves, when you say he deserves it, what are you referring to? What is it that he deserves? His come up?
Yeah, it almost is like a comeuppance as far as the way that the scientists treat him and kind of manipulate him and everything, at least in the final film, because he just seems so... I don't know. He seems a little out there, and he's
alienated.
Yeah,
yeah. That was a kind of a choice that Alan made also, which was, you know, Alan has a kind of a dark quality. He always looks a little bit suspicious. There's something dark about him, which he sort of feels like he's constantly surprising himself by his reactions and what comes out of his mouth and all that. You know, so there's a kind of an undertone of, maybe it's even panic or something. That he sort of brings to the project, and that was a kind of a choice that he made, which is a guy who is not only presumably an alien, but alienated. So I guess that's a fair statement, yeah. And in the final cut, I can see that. You know, it's been a while since I saw the film, so I'm not your best source on that distinction. So.
And the scenes of him and Madeline Kahn, those are just absolutely brilliant. Were those scripted, or did you just kind of let them go?
They're scripted. I'm not of the school of, you know, that improvisation is better than writing. Although, of course, with those two, it wouldn't have been a bad idea to let them improvise, since, you know, Alan, of course, from Second City, and I think even Madeline was at Second City, too. But as it turns out, you know, I was a first-time director, and I suppose a little bit of a, you know, wanted to control things. So it was, those things were scripted. Where did you get the script, by the way? Is it one of those things where you can get it online and they just, you know, they find it from somebody on the project who duplicates them?
It must have been, because it had on one of the pages, it had property of, I think it said property of Paramount. I'm not sure at the time.
Well, you know, the script was submitted to Paramount. They didn't want to do it. That might have been where, yeah, that was when Barry Diller was running Paramount. And then it reverted to Orion. So every once in a while you walk around the streets in New York and some guy will set up a stand with movie scripts for sale for like 15 or 20 bucks. Of all the movies that are out now, like, you know, The Dark Knight, and you can buy a script of The Dark Knight. And I don't know how the hell they get these things. I guess somebody on the crew, you know, will pick up a copy and duplicate it and put it on eBay or something like that.
I was always curious if that was kind of a nod to Ken Russell with his...
Oh, Altered States. I don't know. When was Altered States?
I want to say it was around the same time. I want to say it was...
Was it?
Yeah, because I think both of them have a 1980 release date.
No, I was fascinated what was his name? The guy out in Esalen who developed that whole sensory deprivation thing. I can't remember his name, but that was sort of independent. What's sort of interesting about that sequence is that it was totally unscripted, except for a couple of sentences that say that once he gets out of the tank, Simon recapitulates all of evolution, and you know, I had no idea what we were going to come up with. Alan did that really by himself. I mean, I wrote the narration after, pretty much, but there were some points I wanted him to hit. You know, like, you know, he discovers sexuality, the industrial revolution, whatever it was, and Wally, and so I was sort of calling things out. But we didn't know how we were going to start. And Alan came up to me one day and he said, "What about this?" And he just put his little first finger in front of his face and he wiggled it, you know, like that big close-up shot that starts the sequence. I thought, okay, that's great. And what we, and you know, you asked about improvisation. We just rolled magazine after magazine and let Alan improvise. And he was really spectacular. It was great to see that. And, put it together, and then you know, afterwards we played with it and had Wally do the narration. But that's all Alan. I can't take any credit for that, really, except for the idea.
The thing that I found really fascinating was that he's kind of doing a 2001 riff during that, you know, doing the whole,
yes,
and
right,
you know, the music is kind of playing along with that and everything. And then in your original draft, you had the scientist kind of waking him up in that Louis the 16th bedroom from 2001.
I know, but you know, budget rears its unattractive head.
Oh yeah, I'm sure.
And, in the first draft or in the early draft, you put in, you know, what you think of, and then it's a negotiation as always. You know, Truffaut said, you know, you start out trying to make a masterpiece and you wind up just trying to finish desperately.
What was it like your first time out of the gate?
I've never had stage fright, and I didn't have, I was too stupid to be frightened, I guess. I had a good crew. I remember the very first thing we shot was a scene in up at Columbia University, presumably. I think it was on a stage, but it was Alan in his own little sensory deprivation tank.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where he gets in and Lisa, the character's girlfriend, is there, and she's afraid he's going to go crazy. And the very first shot, when Alan gets into the tank, I heard the operator say, "Director in the shot." So I was standing next to the camera, and I got interested in something, and I moved over. So the very first shot that we ever did, I was in by accident. But other than that, it was okay. You know, it was, you know, you can learn everything that you really need to learn in a very strict technical sense about getting something on screen in a very short time. Things about screen direction, crossing the line, and all that sort of thing. What it takes you a lifetime to learn is, you know, what's interesting and what gets people and what's emotional and so on and so forth. So I would love to make, somebody actually came to me recently, a producer, and said he would like to remake the movie. And boy, that would be great. I'd love, you know, knowing what I know now about, this will sound pretentious, but about just life, you know, after many years and a little about the technique and everything, I would love to make that movie the way it really should be made, because the movie is, you know, it's quirky, it's kind of precocious, it's full of ideas, it's jerky a little bit, but God, I'd love to do it again. But I, you know, I didn't feel that. I you know, what happens when you get on a set is you're deluged with a million questions of little tiny things. So you really don't get overwhelmed by the larger issue of, is this thing worth doing? Is it any good? Am I any good? You know, you're just trying to get through each day and not fuck up too badly. It's really all playing defense as far as I'm concerned.
Now, when you had worked on like Annie Hall and Manhattan and those kind of things, were you involved past the writing stage? Were you actually on the set? Did you kind of pick up from that? Or was this a real totally new experience for you?
This was pretty new. I almost had never been on a movie set except for one brief visit to the set of Sleeper out in Boulder, Colorado, when Woody was shooting that sequence out there. But I was not really present on the... I mean, there's nobody more useless than another writer when Woody Allen is the writer-director. You know, you didn't need that. However, you know, during the shooting, especially of Annie Hall, which was not on location, it was all done around New York, we'd meet occasionally, and he'd call and say, we're at a point, I think we need a little scene or a little joke. You know, that thing in Annie Hall where he and Annie and their two friends are trying some cocaine, and Woody sneezes into the box of cocaine, and it's, you know, $2,000 worth of cocaine. You know, that was something that was added either during the shooting or maybe even after, during the editing process, you know, where, you know, you come to a point where you need a little connector scene or something that allows you to go from one thing to another. So, you know, I was always available kind of on call if Woody needed something, but no, I did not spend time on the set of either of those two films, really, because I was sort of off doing my own things, too.
I don't think that there's ever been a version of Annie Hall where you get to see all of the stuff that was shot for it, because, I mean, wasn't it like hours long when it was finally done?
240. The rough that I saw was about 240, and I was very disappointed. I just thought it didn't go anywhere, and it was like the authors showing how clever they were, and the Annie Alvey story was buried in a whole lot of other material. And then, you know, it's like 90 minutes, barely. And that was Ralph Rosenblum, really, the editor, who really got the thing into shape. And, you know, there were two reshoots on Annie Hall for the ending. We couldn't. There was somehow the movie didn't have a satisfying finish from the first, you know, from the rough cut, and so there was a revision. There was a trip out to California. All that was sort of post principal photography. He got everybody together and did another unit out in L.A. Harder to do that today, but with the way the studios run things. But Woody was able to do it. Yeah.
Did you shoot a lot of stuff for Simon that wasn't used, or were you pretty much on a tight budget and timeline for that one?
No, I think we used pretty much. I mean, I didn't do a whole lot of takes. I didn't. They were not. I'm trying to think now. It's so long. I had a reshoot. I mean, I reshot the ending too. That whole sequence in the spaceship was constructed after we did a cut. Yeah, and it was a different director of photography too. I can't remember his name. But Adam Hollander was the DP on, you know, for the principal photography. And then he went on to do something else. I couldn't get him. And we had, God, I can't remember his name. But we built a whole interior of the shuttle. And that was all done after. It was on the Woody model. You know, you sort of do the film, see what you've got, and then you save a little money. Actually, no, we didn't save it. I had to go back to Orion and say, I need another... whatever it was, you know, $200,000 or $250,000, because I think we have a better ending. And they said, okay. Those were the days. Oh, boy. I mean, it's such a pittance. Well, you know, a format. You know, Annie Hall costs like less than $3 million. I don't know what that is adjusted for inflation, but, you know, is it maybe 20 now, the equivalent? You know, when you read what the negative costs are on some of these other films, you know, it's staggering. Although Woody has stuck pretty much to the template. I mean, his films cost, you know, under $20 million, closer to 16 or 17.
You think he
is the way to,
kind of does that for the autonomy kind of thing?
He does it because they won't give him any more money, essentially. Yes, I mean, partly it's so that he retains control, but I think he gets as much money as they'll give him, based on what they feel the projections might be on the box office.
I don't really see him doing some sort of like 3D computer animated spectacular anytime soon.
Well, you know, I don't know. We've spoken about that. I think, you know, if somebody miraculously, you know, came down out of heaven and said, you know, here's $100 million, do whatever you want, make one movie, I think he'd do it because, you know, why not? But I mean, well, on the other hand, he might say, I'll take the $100 million and I'll make five movies for you. I wanted a particular look for the film and started researching different architects with places. Because, you know, we didn't have the kind of budget where I could really build a lot. I built a certain amount, but we really had to shoot a good deal of it on location. And Richard Meyer is an architect who's a fairly, you know, successful, well-known American architect with that particular kind of look. And I discovered a bunch of places that he had built. Mainly they were residences. There was one residence out in Old Westbury, Long Island, which, you know, he uses that kind of modern, you know, glass and stainless steel kind of stuff. And then there was a place that's no longer around in the Bronx called the Bronx Developmental Center, which was kind of a hospital that was a spectacular futuristic hospital, which I used for the you know, main kind of location. And all of Richard Meyer's architecture has a similarity. So we tied about five or six different locations all around New York and the suburbs into one location. And Adam Hollander was an amazing, you know, Pauline Kael reviewed, much to my surprise, reviewed this movie as looking like a Stanley Kubrick movie, which was a very nice compliment, certainly to the photographer. And so the movie does have a kind of a nice look to it, you know, mainly because of Richard Meyer's buildings, which were already there, and Adam, who photographed them very prettily, I thought.
Well, yeah, I mean, I've watched this, rewatched it now twice this week, and I have to say it still holds up, you know, 30-some years later.
All right, well, don't watch it a third time. Just, you know, so just keep that thought. Anything else?
I had one more question for you. This might be one of those vicious internet rumors, but I had read that you had something to do with the song Dueling Banjos.
Well, oh God, that's a long story. I was a bluegrass banjo player for my whole life, starting from when I was 12 years old. I was fascinated by that. And I was a Jewish kid from Brooklyn who got infatuated with bluegrass. And became pretty good at it, actually. And when I got out of college, I joined this group called the Tarriers, which brings us back to the beginning of our conversation. One of the other guys in the Tarriers was an old friend of mine named Eric Weisberg, and he was also a bluegrass freak. And while we were touring with the Tarriers, we worked out a whole series of bluegrass songs, some of which we wrote, some of which we adapted, and we recorded it on an album for a then small folk label called Elektra Records. This was like in the middle 60s. And it was called New Dimensions in Banjo and Bluegrass. And it was kind of a modern, two guys playing. And we got a fiddle player and a guitar player and all that. And we recorded it out in California, in Los Angeles. And it was released, and it sold about 110 copies worldwide. Okay? Nothing. Then I leave the music business, and I'm working for Carson. And I get a call from this is now 1969, I guess. I get a call from my accountant, and he says, I have a check on my desk from Warner Brothers Music for $160,000. What did you do? I said, I have no idea. And here's the story. When John Borman was making Deliverance, in the script was this scene with this kid playing the banjo and one of the guys having a little, you know, duet with him before they go down the river. And John got in touch with my old college roommate and co-terrier, Eric Weisberg, and asked him to come down and record Dueling Banjos. just for that little sequence, for the soundtrack. When the movie came out, Deliverance, they started to do radio commercials, and somebody at Warner Brothers in the publicity department decided to take the dueling banjo sequence and use it as the background for a one-minute spot about going to see Deliverance. Right? And for some reason, people in Detroit started to call in and say, what's that song? Where can I get it? So Warner Brothers released it as a single, and it charted as a single. And then they were looking for an album to cover it with, because you don't make money on a single, but you make money on an album. And what they did was, since Warner Brothers Records had, in the interim, acquired Elektra Records and their catalog, they took our album, they took the first band off side one, and they slapped Dueling Banjos onto it. They reissued that album called New Dimensions in Banjo and Bluegrass. They reissued it and called it the soundtrack from Deliverance, which it was not. And it sold 700,000 copies in a couple of months.
Wow.
It just went platinum about 3 months ago because Eric sent me the platinum record. So ever since 1969 or so, it has been a... And, you know, because they were all folk songs, except for Dueling Banjos, which was actually a written song by a guy named Arthur Guitar Boogie Smith, who then later sued, but that's a whole other story. All that stuff was arranged and adapted by me and Eric, so we split about 30 cents an album on this album. So every year I would get these checks from something that I had absolutely nothing to do with. That's one of those stories. Actually, I was in psychoanalysis at that time years ago, and my analyst used to say to me, you know, you can't expect something to just drop out of the sky and solve all of your problems. And then I said one day, I said, well, guess what? So, you know, that album, in a sense, gave me a little bit of financial security enough to get out of television and concentrate on doing films and stuff. So that's the story. And so the album has now finally, after 30 years, gone platinum, and it's still a kind of a healthy seller around the world. And a lot of the younger generation of bluegrass players, you know, like Bella Fleck, I don't know if you know who he is, but there's, you know, a big research. Even Steve Martin, who's a friend, says that he learned to play the banjo by listening to our record, by listening to the New Dimensions album. So that's the story of I'd like to say that I had something to do with it, but I didn't. That was Eric and somebody else playing the Dueling Banjos on the soundtrack of Deliverance, but they kind of hijacked our old album and re-released it. And so I sort of wrote in on that. It's a weird story, huh?
Before we forget to say, you can get Simon, actually. It was unavailable on DVD for a while, but it's actually one of those things, sort of like when we did Hickey and Boggs about a year ago. It's now available in a burn-on-demand program. In this case, it's available through the Warner Archives. And we have a link where you can get that through our website at projection-booth.com. Now, Mike, I noticed a little bit of crosstalk in the interview. You were talking about the screenplay to Simon, but Mr. Brickman was talking about Sleeper, or maybe you got a little confused there. I know that you've read both for both films. Could you give a little insight into the screenplays and how they came out into the finished films?
Sleeper actually really kind of held pretty close to what was there on the page, at least the version that I read, which I think was from, I want to say, like February of 73. And there was the chess scene that Mr. Brickman was talking about. And then it goes into a concerto scene with, it's Woody Allen trying to play a violin and the bow goes limp. And they even say in the screenplay, you know, the obvious Freudian symbolism that is involved here and yada, yada. But it pretty much held close to what I read as far as that draft. But the draft of Simon really differed. The first draft of that was August 15th, 1977, and we know that the movie of Simon came out in 1980, so there was definitely a long time in there for things to change. The first thing that changed was Simon's name. It was Simon Munn, not Simon Mendelssohn, and instead of a professor, he's actually a troublemaking student who's going to get kicked out of school unless he becomes part of this experiment. There's no sensory deprivation tank whatsoever. They use hypnosis to get him to where he needs to be, and they also break down his ego quite a bit with the Lisa character, who's played by Madeline Kahn. She's not necessarily a fellow professor, but she's just this girl that he finds when he gets really depressed and he goes out in the desert in his Volkswagen and pours gasoline all over himself and he's going to self-immolate. And then she comes along and not necessarily talks him out of it, but they get to talking and then he falls in love with her. And it turns out that she's an actress who's been hired by the professors in the Brain Trust. And they end up telling her to break it off with him. So there's just the one female character instead of the two that we have in the finished film, where we've got Judy Grobart as Lisa. There is no Lisa character. Well, there is a Lisa character, but she's pretty much Dr. Cynthia Mallory. So I don't know if that makes any sense or not.
See, I think it works actually to have the two, because in that way there's a little bit of a tension, which you see in the film, between who he would like to be with versus who he is with and how he deals with this whole concept of commitment and relationships and all of those things that come with being with someone over a period of time.
There's a little bit different thing as far as the gas goes, the gas that makes all of the professors, except for Dr. Becker, into idiots. It's actually Simon's mouse that he has genetically reprogrammed to think that it's a cat, and he escapes through these ducts and everything, and he knocks the gas over and poisons the entire place. So Becker and everybody are completely turned into babbling idiots, and then the gas escapes even wider out into the community and turns whole towns into cities of idiots. He never comes on TV, which I think is the other really major difference. The whole third part where he is basically the prophet really isn't there. He does find this cult. They don't worship TV. He goes from the cult, and then he is basically is a man on the run story. There is one part where he does try to get people in charge to change television. He wants Welcome Back, Cotter, Bowling for Dollars, and the Waltons off the air. He wants them replaced by Hard Jazz, Norman Mailer, and a special airing of Deep Throat on primetime. And then the other thing is the computer Doris that they have in the film, she ends up being kind of the bad guy at the very end. They go all the way back to Columbia University, and they find that there is a computer that lives under the library that controls all information in the United States. And he goes down and plants a bomb on her. And there's even a part where he talks about how he's planting a nuclear bomb in this mother computer and how Freud would have a field day with this, because it's basically he's going to give her this atomic-powered orgasm. It's kind of like another 2001 reference where it's, you know, Dave destroying Hal. So, which is interesting too, because then I rewatched Sleeper yesterday, and there's that very Hal-like computer that's helping Woody Allen perform the cloning on the leader. And, you know, we keep getting these shots of the computerized eye and everything. So I see a whole lot of parallels between the two films, really.
And there would be, because, I mean, obviously he did work on both.
Yeah, it seems like he might have gotten some ideas while he was working on Sleeper and just kind of was refining those as he was going along. I mean, it was nice to see the way that things kind of came up and changed. You know, some of the jokes are there at the very beginning of this screenplay for Simon. You know, like the computer says, you know, I will provide you with the mystery of Orange Julius, you know, what that fantastic white powder is that they put in the drink. And then that becomes a joke, but in a different form in the finished film. So it's just kind of moving things around over that time.
Knowing that he did write this, and then when you watch Simon, if you have seen Sleeper, which I have, but I'll admit that it's been probably 10 years more since I've seen it last. If you watch it and keep in mind that Alan Arkin maybe would have been Woody Allen, there's a lot of times where you can go, I can totally see Woody Allen playing this. There's several points where I see that is specifically related to the relationship stuff with the women. I totally see that. I see that with sort of
his academic character, certain bits of humor, jokes, things like that. The one place where I would not be able to see Woody Allen do this, and it's not to say that he couldn't pull it off if he really worked on it, is that whole Evolution Dawn of Man thing that I talked about, where it's so physical comedy that I don't think he had the chops to do that. I think that Alan Arkin pulls that off because he has that physical comedy chops that he learned doing improv that I don't think Woody Allen would have been able to get near in terms of being able to pull that off the way that Arkin did.
With Alan, he always has that kind of self-deprecating thing where he always has to kind of add that final joke to say, you know, the way that things did or did not work with him and his mother or him and his girlfriend or something like that. Whereas with Arkin, he always just kind of takes stuff up a notch as he's going along. So he kind of works on that manic energy, just getting, you know, higher and higher. I mean, Alan can get manic and can move his hands a lot and kind of get into things when he's, you know, talking about his love of New York or something like that. But with Arkin, it seems like he just kind of gets angrier and angrier as he goes along, which I think is perfect for this character. I mean, with Miles and Sleeper, he just kind of gets dropped into this place, you know, 200 years in the future, and is separated from that, whereas Simon is much more invested in what's going on at that particular time because he's living in that time.
Yes.
So what do you want to say about the production?
Well, the one thing that's interesting about the production is I'm one of these geeks that likes to read the credits. And when I was reading the credits, you know, we were like, oh, Wallace Shawn's in it, and Max Wright's in it, and all these folks are in it, was one of the interesting credits that's in there, and it may slip by you if you're not someone who knows who producers are and stuff like that, was casting was done by Scott Rudin. Now, Scott Rudin, from my understanding, this was one of his first films that he worked on. Now, he's gone on to be a major producer, a lot of stuff with Paramount, and his stuff is, you know, well-known stuff and also really acclaimed things that have a sort of an odd sensibility. So Clueless, he did the South Park movie, did Team America, Wonder Boys, he did three films with Wes Anderson, he did No Country for Old Men, There Will Be Blood, Social Network, True Grit. So I don't know, maybe his time working with Mr. Brickman in a way maybe helped to pave the way for Scott Rudin to get into film further and to, you know, make some really great films over the last 30 years. That's all we have time for this week. Make sure to come back for next week's episode as we bring you one of the most outrageous spaghetti westerns around. It's called Django Kill If You Live, Shoot. And that's right, Django. You know what's coming out in just a few days. Django Unchained. That's right, Mr. Tarantino. Well, we're going to show you an even more outrageous spaghetti western that I'm sure Django Unchained is going to be. Also, don't forget to stop by our website, projection-booth.com. Leave us some feedback. And also, you can get the show on iTunes. You can stream it on Stitcher. And if you're on iTunes, make sure to leave us some stars and a review because we like that very much. Otherwise, we may have to shoot you.
That's right. You know, the more stars we get, the closer we come to taking over the world. So please leave us a voicemail. Send us an MP3 for our February 13th shows on Reservoir Dogs. Speaking of Quentin Tarantino, leave us your thoughts about Reservoir Dogs, Django Unchained, if you happen to see it, any other Tarantino films that you might want to talk about. The number to call is 734-666-0800. And remember, it's free when you call from work.
Yeehaw.
Mr. Sandman, quiero llorar, pero mi llanto no puede brotar. Ponen mis ojos un poco de arena para que pueda disipar mis penas. Nada me importa ya, nadie acompaña mi soledad. Ten piedad de mi pena, Mr. Sandman, quiero llorar. Ten piedad de mi pena, Mr. Sandman. De mi pena.
Okay, stay with me now because this is really great. Nuclear rockets, huge ones, hundreds of them on one side of the world. And when the planet runs out of food and air and water,
which it will, probably, what do we do? Huh? Anybody? What do we do? I'll tell you what we do. We turn the planet into a spaceship, and we move to another solar system where there is food and water and air. It can happen. Anything can happen. Dare to dream. Use the right side of your brains, intuition, imagination, dreams, uncertainty. Remember we talked about the uncertainty principle? Well, Heisenberg is predated 1,000 years by the Zen poets. 1,000 years. You can change the world with an idea. But you have to think of the idea first.